Discerning Hearts, in cooperation with Ignatius Press, present Great Works in Modern Literature with Joseph Pierce. Joseph Pierce is a writer in residence and associate professor of literature at Ave Maria University. He is the editor-in-chief of Ave Maria University Communications and Sapientia Press, as well as co-editor of the St. Austin Review, an international review of Christian culture, literature, and ideas published in England and the United States. He is also the author of many books, including literary biographies of Solzhenitsyn, J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, and Oscar Wilde. And he's the series editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions, on which this series is based. Great Works in Modern Literature with Joseph Pierce. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. The Ignatius Critical Edition series represents a tradition-oriented approach to reading the classics of world literature. While many modern critical editions have succumbed to the fads of modernism and postmodernism, this series concentrates on critical examinations informed by our Judeo-Christian heritage as passed down throughout the ages, the same heritage that provided the crucible in which the great authors formed these classic works. Edited by acclaimed literary biographer Joseph Pierce, the Ignatius Critical Edition ensures that readings of the works are filtered through the richness of Western tradition, meeting the authors in their element, instead of the currently popular method of deconstructing a classic to fit a modern mindset, a lamentable flaw that often proliferates in other series of critical editions. The Ignatius Critical Editions are ideal for anyone wishing to understand the great works of Western civilization, enabling the modern reader to enjoy these classics in the company of some of the finest literature professors alive today. We now begin our conversation with Joseph Pierce. Welcome, Joseph.
It's good to be here.
Talk to us about the driving force behind the Ignatius Critical Editions.
Well, a few years ago here at Ave Maria University, I was teaching a course on Romanticism, and I ordered for my students a set text of Frankenstein and a set text of Wuthering Heights, and was horrified by the critical material that was part of that critical edition, the essays, the introduction, the footnotes. The whole thing was geared towards relativism, anti-Christianity, various other aspects of the postmodern culture. And I just thought to myself, well, first of all, why am I patronizing this stuff, this material, giving money to it basically by setting it for 30 students? And secondly, why am I putting this into the hands of my students anyway? So I thought, well, you know, you can just complain about something or you can do something about it. So I suggested to Father Fezzio at Ignatius Press that we launch the Ignatius Critical Editions to give critical editions which give emphasis to the traditional-oriented approach to criticism and to understanding the works, something which would have been closer to the understanding of the works of the authors themselves. And thankfully, Father Fezzio said yes, and that was the birth of the series.
It's a wonderful series. The selection of authors and books are wide-ranging, and in particular, the fact that they come from that British English-American background. It really opens those authors up for us.
Yeah, well, I think that obviously there is, Britain and America are united by a common language, and that does tie into the common culture. And so these works speak to not just to both cultures, but across the generations. So something written in, say, Charles Dickens, for instance, or Emily Bronte, written in 19th century England, still speaks very powerfully to the issues that drive life in 21st century America. Because, you know, human nature is essentially unchanging. Therefore, the problems involved with human nature and the temptations to immorality and the necessity of virtue, these things don't change. So the great works of literature express that in a very profound way. So we have this common language, we have up to a point, therefore, this common culture, and these great works speak a common language of morality.
They cover the era of the 18th century, 19th century into the 20th century, at a time when people read. Today, we don't read to the depth that those in that time did. And the reason I bring that up is because, frankly, movies or dramatizations that have appeared in serial versions on television, which is not enough to understand the relevance of these works.
Well, that's the trouble, is that we live in a culture which is much more shallow than the culture of the past. So there's two things happening here. On the one hand, we're sort of told that we're living in a culture which is advancing, progressing, and that's because of technology. And there's no doubt at all, of course, that in technological terms, there have been advances. But one of the offshoots of technology is actually culturally and intellectually, we're actually being stunted because the film media does not go to the depth that literature can go to. And if we're happy just watching movies, or worse still, you know, playing computer games, then we're now engaging reality on a much lower level, a much more shallow level than our ancestors did, who read these great works of literature. And in consequence, we're producing what T.S. Eliot called the hollow men, people with no roots, no real understanding of philosophy or theology or history or culture. And consequently, we're living in an age which is going backwards in those very, very crucial terms. And so that's why a series like the Ignatius Critical Editions, which aims to bring these great works of literature to new generations with these accompanying essays and introductions, I think is invaluable and indeed priceless. And you know, I hope that many, many people take advantage of them.
Just the wealth that we have here, everyone from William Shakespeare to Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Mary Shelley, Harriet Beecher Stowe, names that we may have heard in our high school or college lit classes, but maybe haven't revisited in a very long time. One of the things that the editions do so beautifully is it always brings back to their cultural experience and what they are writing from, as opposed to some editions now that take a twist to try to make it relevant in our cultural milieu.
Well, yeah, in what the particular critics think should be our cultural milieu, more to the point. I mean, that one of the problems of modern criticism is a narcissistic reading where we just use the text to further our own agenda. So it's just something which makes us feel good. Whereas in actual fact, great works of literature allow us to grow in the space of the genius who wrote the work. We need to approach these works, you know, with humility, on our knees, if you like, to recognize that William Shakespeare is a bigger genius than we are. And therefore, if we really want to grow in knowledge and wisdom, we have to see the work through the eyes of the author as far as possible. So through the eyes of William Shakespeare, for instance. That means you have to understand, you know, what were William Shakespeare's beliefs? You know, what were his theological beliefs? What were his philosophical beliefs? What was the sort of age in which he was living? What was the politics and the religion of that age? And the timeless truths that emerge from seeing the truth through William Shakespeare's eyes, for instance, or these other great authors, allows us to see reality and therefore to see ourselves more clearly. Whereas if we insist on ignoring the author and just putting into a work what we want to get out of it, we don't grow at all.
There's a danger in that on several different levels, and we can see that again in the dramatizations of many of these works, because we don't realize the influence of a director or a screenwriter to put his slant on how something is portrayed. So if we think we understand when we read a Huckleberry Finn, or if we take a look at Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, we may not be getting what that author was trying to communicate.
Absolutely. If you started school, say you come to a good university as a freshman, and you tell the professor on the very first day, you know, I know all there is to know about this subject, there's nothing you can teach me, you'd be thrown out of the school. At least I hope you would. But that's exactly how, you know, so many postmoderns approach these great works of literature. Now, they're in the presence of a genius, like Charles Dickens, you just mentioned. And yet they think that Charles Dickens has nothing to teach them. But on the contrary, they have things to teach Charles Dickens. So they can look at what they consider to be some prejudice in his ideas, or what they consider to be his getting politics wrong, or whatever. So it's like this snotty-nosed kid who's just arrived at a university telling the professor, I know more about this subject than you do. You do not know Great Expectations better than Charles Dickens does. Get used to the idea, and with humility, try to see Great Expectations as Charles Dickens sees it, and you will grow into a bigger, stronger, more intelligent person.
What's wonderful about the editions as well is the selection, again, when you use Dickens' Great Expectations, many of us are familiar with David Copperfield. Great Expectations shows the maturity of the author, and that's another with Jane Austen. You see that with Pride and Prejudice, but then there's the newer edition now of Mansfield Park, and many people aren't aware of that, but you see the maturity, the growing of the author.
Right, and of course, by looking at authors, seeing how they grow, you see what they have to show us. I'll give you an example. I teach Litrad 1 every year to my students, so that's classical epic. It's often done that people will just teach Antigone rather than the whole Oedipus cycle, or they teach Antigone last because it comes last in the story. In actual fact, it's important to teach all three plays and to teach Antigone first, because that was written when the playwright was young. Mm-hmm. And then Oedipus at Colonus is written when he's an old man. In fact, it's not performed till after he dies. So you read the three plays in the order in which they were written, and you see this intellectual and spiritual and philosophical and theological growth in the author. You see his progress. And of course, we're progressing with him. We're seeing what he learns. And mm-hmm. So that's why I always teach them in the order of composition and not in the order of the story. And I think that what you're saying, the same thing with the authors, that to be able to compare an early work by Dickens or Jane Austen or William Shakespeare with their later work, you actually see the progress they made in the intellectual life and the spiritual life. And of course, in seeing that, we also benefit because we've been taking on that journey with them.
There's great fun and joy in doing that as well. We've learned that from the study of art. And literature is art. And the reason I draw that parallel is because you look at the work of Michelangelo, you look at his earlier works like the Pietà, then you look at the last one and you see what happened to Michelangelo, or you look at a Rembrandt from the beginning and then you see his conversion. I mean, a lot of times with these authors, there's this element of a turning towards something.
Right. I mean, life is a journey. We go right back. We're still on the subject of the Greeks, perhaps, you know, the Odyssey. You know, there's something metaphorical about Homer's Odyssey because it's about a journey home. And so life is about that journey home. Are we making progress on that journey? Or are we making no progress? Or are we going in the wrong direction? And these are lessons that are relevant to every single one of us. So to be able to see how great men, great minds dealt with these great issues and made the progress along the way and relayed that progress in the majesty of their work, whether it be a great writer like Shakespeare or a great artist like Michelangelo. Then, of course, we tap into that. If you imagine our intellects are like a hut or a house, well, we can walk into a cathedral because the space of someone like, you know, Michelangelo, Leonardo, William Shakespeare, Beethoven, Mozart, Bach. I mean, we're moving into a space which genius provides that gives us the room to grow into, but only if we're willing to see our own house as being something which is not the final word, that there's something bigger and better if we have the humility to approach it as such.
Now, as the series editor on this particular series, what is your hope? What's the goal for those who you're calling to come back into these works for the first time?
Well, I'm hoping that the series as a whole will help lead towards a restoration of tradition-oriented culture seen through the perspective of a tradition-oriented approach. So I'm hoping that it will be used by parents who are homeschooling their children, by good principals and teachers, Catholic, Christian, and non-Catholic high schools, and college and university professors, so that actually we can counter the poison that's been out there in the academy for the last 50 years with ultimately the truth. And I'm not speaking about the truth in a relativistic sense. I'm talking about seeing the works objectively through the eyes of the authors themselves. This is the way to approach these great works of literature, and that's the vision behind the series. If the series is a success, then the vision will be a success, and that will play a significant role towards the restoration of culture. Not enough by itself, but it will be a contributing factor in that.
Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, Chapter 1. Notice: persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot, by order of the author, per G.G., Chief of Ordnance. Explanatory. In this book, a number of dialects are used, to wit, the Missouri Negro dialect, the extremist form of the backwoods southwestern dialect, the ordinary Pike County dialect, and 4 modified varieties of this last. The shadings have not been done in a haphazard fashion, or by guesswork, but painstakingly, and with the trustworthy guidance and support of personal familiarity with these several forms of speech. I make this explanation for the reason that without it, many readers would suppose that all these characters were trying to talk alike, and not succeeding. The Author. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Scene, the Mississippi Valley. Time, 40 to 50 years ago. Chapter 1. Civilizing Huck, Miss Watson, Tom Sawyer Waits. You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. But that ain't no matter. That book was made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth, mainly. There was things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth. That is nothing. I never seen anybody but lied one time or another without it was Aunt Polly or the widow, or maybe Mary. Aunt Polly, Tom's Aunt Polly she is, and Mary and the widow Douglas is all told about in that book, which is mostly a true book, with some stretchers, as I said before.
Now let's talk briefly about the makeup of each book, because it is a critical edition. First, what makes it a critical edition, and how did you make the selection on the editors?
Well, the first thing, of course, it contains the entire text of the work. Then we have new annotation, new footnotes. So again, because footnotes can also pursue an agenda, so we want to make sure the footnotes are in accordance with tradition-oriented reading. Then the editor of the edition will write the introduction, normally, and also be responsible for the selection of contributing essays. We send out a call for papers to hundreds of academics around the world when we set out a new call for papers, and we get these essays back in, and the selection is made. And so what we have at the end is a good solid introduction by the editor of the edition, the full text of the work with new notes to the text, and then a selection of critical essays by some of the world's leading tradition-oriented academics. And the result of that is a fully rounded coverage of the work, whereas, quite frankly, a lay reader, so for instance, an adult who's not in formal education, can pick up a copy of these, read the introduction, read the work, read the critical essays, and have a really good understanding of what's going on in those works.
It's like a great blend of nonfiction and fiction.
Exactly. The fiction is the story. And if you like, what the critical essays, the introduction, and the notes allow us is to see the truth that emerges from the story.
I think for reading groups as well, these would be very important works. Instead of racing out and getting the latest, forgive me, but the latest Oprah book, this would be the perfect book to be able to sit down and to really enter into those adult discussions.
Exactly, especially if you had a reading group that wanted to go one step deeper. So you could actually read the whole text, but then after you read the whole text, you could either as the group together or just get people to go away and discuss some of the essays, some of the critical essays mm-hmm. at the back, and say, do we agree with that approach? Having read it, do we think this person's right? Do we think this person's wrong? And why? So it actually acts as a launching pad for a deeper engagement with the work. And of course, each of the editions also has a study guide, which, mm-hmm. either in a formal setting for education or for reading groups, the study guide itself asks the questions. And that itself would be a wonderful launching pad for further discussion. So if you had a reading group that wanted to go that one step deeper, in the presence of some of the great academics, without having to pay tens of thousands of dollars to go back to school, then this series obviously is ideal.
The one thing that jumps out at me, too, is the fact that the majority of the books, they're 19th century books. So you're at a time in literature where the serialization of books is occurring in newsprint to be able to encourage readership. The stories are compelling. Each point, because there's like a cliffhanger during the course of the novel, chapter after chapter after chapter, it was to encourage further reading. So they're not dull.
Well, absolutely not dull. And also the fact that in those days, people would buy a magazine in order to read the next installment of Charles Dickens' latest novel, apart from the fact what a wonderful time that would be to be around, mm-hmm. to be able to do that. These works are engaging chapter by chapter by chapter. And I think sometimes we're sort of scared. We think somehow that we don't understand the past. Well, even something really difficult, in inverted commas, like Chaucer, you know, which is in Middle English, quite frankly, with half an hour of effort, particularly perhaps with the aid of a teacher in that case, you can read Chaucer. Now, if you can read Chaucer, which is English written 700 years ago, then really Dickensian English, 150 or so years ago, is not difficult at all. It just merely takes a little bit of effort in the first instance just to, should we say, move our mind up a gear. That's all it takes. And really, you know, we don't argue about having to go on the treadmill to get our physical bodies in gear, to have to go out to 6 miles an hour instead of 4 miles an hour. Well, that's all that's really necessary, is to put your mind up a gear, and it's good for the mind, because if we don't exercise our mind, it becomes as weak and flabby as our bodies if we don't exercise our bodies.
And that's the goal of great literature, isn't it? Ultimately, is to put us in those situations in our mind, so that if we encounter them in life, we've practiced the virtue it's calling us to.
Absolutely. I mean, the purpose of life, which the modern world seems to have forgotten, is the purpose of growing old is to grow up. You know, we live in an age where, you know, people want to act as if they're 25 when they're 65. And that is, quite frankly, an example of arrested development. These people have not grown to be the people they need to be. And great literature teaches us how to grow up. Because we see all these circumstances in life, which in those exact circumstances we're not going to experience, but something akin to them, something analogous to them, we would experience it sometime or other. How do these great characters respond to that? The virtuous characters, how do they respond? Or the characters who make the big mistakes, how do they respond? What are the consequences of those actions? What does that teach us? And so they're life lessons that all of us need to learn, and not merely as children, but throughout life, because all of us are called to continue growing up until we die, at which point, please God, we'll be fit to move on to the next stage of life.
Mm-hmm. Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, Chapter 60. Elizabeth's spirit soon rising to playfulness again, she wanted Mr. Darcy to account for his having ever fallen in love with her. "How could you begin?" said she. "I can comprehend your going on charmingly when once you had made a beginning, but what could set you off in the first place?"
"I cannot fix on the hour, or the spot, or the look, or the words which laid the foundation. It is too long ago. I was in the middle before I knew that I had begun."
"My beauty you had early withstood, and as for my manners, my behaviour to you was at least always bordering on the uncivil, and I never spoke to you without rather wishing to give you pain than not. Now be sincere. Did you admire me for my impertinence?"
"For the liveliness of your mind, I did."
"You may as well call it impertinence at once. It was very little less. The fact is that you were sick of civility, of deference, of officious attention. You were disgusted with the women who were always speaking and looking and thinking for your approbation alone. I roused and interested you because I was so unlike them. Had you not been really amiable, you would have hated me for it. But in spite of the pains you took to disguise yourself, your feelings were always noble and just, and in your heart you thoroughly despised the persons who so assiduously courted you. There, I have saved you the trouble of accounting for it, and really, all things considered, I begin to think it perfectly reasonable. To be sure, you knew no actual good of me, but nobody thinks of that when they fall in love."
"Was there no good in your affectionate behaviour to Jane while she was ill at Netherfield?"
"Dearest Jane, who could have done less for her? But make a virtue of it by all means. My good qualities are under your protection, and you are to exaggerate them as much as possible. And in return it belongs to me to find occasions for teasing and quarrelling with you as often as may be. And I shall begin directly by asking you what made you so unwilling to come to the point at last. What made you so shy of me when you first called, and afterwards dined here? Why, especially when you called, did you look as if you did not care about me?"
"Because you were grave and silent, and gave me no encouragement."
"But I was embarrassed."
"And so was I."
"You might have talked to me more when you came to dinner."
"A man who had felt less might."
"How unlucky that you should have a reasonable answer to give, and that I should be so reasonable as to admit it. But I wonder how long you would have gone on, if you had been left to yourself. I wonder when you would have spoken if I had not asked you. My resolution of thanking you for your kindness to Lydia had certainly great effect. Too much, I am afraid,
for what becomes of the moral if our comfort springs from a breach of promise? For I ought not to have mentioned the subject. This will never do. You need not distress yourself. The moral be perfectly fair.
Well, I'm looking forward to the series. Each author, each title really demonstrates there's really nothing new under the sun, that many of the things that they've encountered, if we just take the time of reading it, we'll find that there's a lot of answers even to today's issues.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the other thing, see, if you have a six-year-old child, you expect them to listen to their parents because their parents have more experience. Well, what about if you have a 600-year-old or 6,000-year-old culture? Don't those thousands of years of experience teach us something about life? Mm-hmm. If it's true of a parent who's 25, surely it's even more true of a culture that's 2,500 years old. So we can learn everything from Homer and Aristotle and Plato right through to the modern day. This great heritage of Western culture allows us to learn the experience which we don't have and can't have without tapping into that.
It would be a shame if, as parents, as teachers, just for all of us out in the world, not to take the great authors, the great literature of the past, and encourage our young, encourage those around us to use those as a guide to build on so that we can in the future have these great stories. For example, in art, you can see the progression where Fra Angelico, his influence and what he learned, you end up getting to a Caravaggio to taught us so much. And it's the same with literature, isn't it?
Exactly. The epigraph we use for every single one of the Ignatius Critical Editions is from G.K. Chesterton. The essence of that is that tradition is the extension of democracy through time. It's the proxy of the dead and the enfranchisement of the unborn. In other words, it's a living tradition that teaches us about the human experience, the human condition over thousands of years. If we turn our back on that, we're condemning ourselves to a very, very blinkered, myopic, ignorant view of ourselves and our neighbor.
Joseph Pierce, this is going to be a wonderful series. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Great Works in Modern Literature with Joseph Pierce. This series is based on the Ignatius Critical Editions, which represent a traditional-oriented approach to reading the classics of world literature. While many modern critical editions have succumbed to the fads of modernism and postmodernism, this series concentrates on critical examinations informed by our Judeo-Christian heritage as passed down through the ages, the same heritage that provided the crucible in which the great authors framed these classic works. For more information about this important series, go to Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press. To hear and download this episode along with many others, go to www.discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Great Works in Modern Literature with Joseph Pierce.